Olive.
I guess it's not the funniest thing I ever heard.
Olive looks at the black-suited body of Carrie sprawled there on the bed and wishes there were a door to close or a curtain to draw so they didn't have to see the rise of this girl's rear end, her black stockings outlining the slim calves of her legs.
Does Eddie Jr. know?
Yeah, seems she told him yesterday.
Thought he knew too, but he says he didn't. He says he doesn't believe it's true. It may not be.
Shit, says Marlene, shaking her head, crying again. Mrs. Kittredge, if you don't mind, I'd like to just say shit.
Say shit,
says Olive, who never uses the word herself.
Shit, says Marlene. Shit, shit, shit.
I guess so.
Olive breathes in deeply.
I guess so,
she says again, slowly. She looks around her with little interest. A picture of a cat is on one wall, and her glance comes back to Marlene, who is squeezing her nose.
Quite a day, kiddo. Vomit upstairs and cigarette butts downstairs.
The woman with the long gray hair has really shaken Olive up. Seismic spells itself across her fog-colored mind. She says,
that creature who bought Christopher's house. She's walking around putting her cigarettes out in your plants.
Oh, her, says Marlene. She's a piece of shit, too.
I guess so.
She's going to tell this to Henry tomorrow. She'll tell him the whole thing, only he won't like hearing the word shit.
Olive, could I ask you to do me a favor?
I wish you would.
Could you, please?
And here the poor woman looks so bereft, dazed in her green-flowered dress, her brown hair coming loose from its pins.
Before you leave, could you go upstairs in the bedroom? Turn right at the top of the stairs. In the closet you'll find pamphlets, you know, of different places to go. Could you take them with you? Just take them with you and throw them all away. The basket they're in, too.
Of course.
Marlene has tears running down past her nose. She wipes her face with a bare hand.
I don't want to open that closet door, knowing it's there.
Yes, says Olive. I can do that.
She brought Henry's shoes home from the hospital, put them in a bag in the garage, and they are still there. They were new, bought just a few days before the last time they pulled into the parking lot of Shop and Save.
Any other stuff, if you want, Marlene?
No, Olive. It's that we sat there and made believe we'd go places together.
Marlene shakes her head.
Even after Dr. Stanley told us what the situation was, we'd go through these pamphlets, talking about the trips we'd take when he got well.
She rubs her face with both hands.
Gosh, Olive.
Marlene stops and looks at the knife Olive is holding.
Oh, gosh, Olive. I'm so embarrassed.
And it seems she really is. Her cheeks are flushing a deep pink, now a deep red.
No need to be, Olive tells her. We all want to kill someone at some point.
Olive's ready right now to say, if Marlene wants to hear, the different people she might like to kill. But Marlene says,
no, not that, not that. That I sat there with him and we planned those trips.
She tears at the Kleenex, which is pretty well shredded.
Gosh, Olive, it was like we believed it. And there he was, losing weight, so weak. Marlene, bring over the basket of trips, he'd say. And I would. It makes me so embarrassed now, Olive.
An innocent, Olive thinks, gazing at this woman. A real one. You don't find them anymore. Boy, you do not. Olive stands up and walks to the window over the little sink, looking down onto the driveway. People are leaving now, the last of them. Matt Grierson gets into his truck, backs out, drives away. And here comes Molly Collins with her husband, walking over the gravel in her low pumps. She put in a full day's work, Molly did, just trying to do her best, Olive thinks. Just a woman with false teeth and an old husband, who in two shakes will be dead like the rest of them, or worse, sitting next to Henry in a wheelchair. She wants to tell Marlene how she and Henry talked about the grandchildren they would have, the happy Christmases with their nice daughter-in-law, how only a little more than a year ago they would go to Christopher's house for dinner, and the tension would be so thick you could put your hand against it, and they'd still come home and say to each other what a nice girl she was, how glad they were that Christopher had this nice wife. Who does not have their basket of trips? It isn't right. Molly Collins said that today, standing out by the church. It isn't right. Well, it isn't. She would like to rest a hand on Marlene's head, but this is not the kind of thing Olive is especially able to do. So she goes and stands near the chair Marlene sits on, gazing out that side window there, looking down at the shoreline, which is wide now that the tide's almost gone out. She thinks of Eddie Jr. down there skipping stones, and she can only just remember that feeling herself, being young enough to pick up a rock, throw it out to sea with force, still young enough to do that. Throw that damn stone. Ship in a Bottle. You'll have to organize your days, Anita Harwood was saying, wiping at the kitchen counter. Julie, I mean this. People go crazy in prisons and the army because of this exactly. Winnie Harwood, who at 11 years old was younger by 10 years than her sister Julie, watched Julie, who was looking at the floor and leaning against the doorway, wearing the red hooded sweatshirt and jeans that she'd slept in. Julie's hands were jammed into her pockets, and Winnie, whose adolescent feelings for her sister amounted these days to almost a crush, tried unobtrusively to put her own hands into her own pockets and lean against the table with the indifference that Julie appeared to have at what was being said. "For example," continued their mother, "what are your plans for today?" She stopped wiping the counter and looked over at Julie. Julie did not look up. Only recently had Winnie's feelings teetered from her mother to her sister. Her mother had won beauty pageants before Julie was born, and she still looked pretty to Winnie. It was like having more candy than other people or getting stars on homework papers to have the mother who looked the best. A lot of them were fat or had stupid hair or wore their husbands' woolen shirts over jeans with elastic waistbands. Anita never left the house without lipstick and high heels and her fake pearl earrings. Only lately had Winnie started to have the uncomfortable sense that something was wrong, or might be wrong, with her mother, that others talked about her in a certain eye-rolling way. She'd have given anything for this not to be the case, and maybe it wasn't. She just didn't know. "Because of this, exactly?" Julie asked, looking up. "In prisons and the army? Mom, I'm dying, and you're saying stuff that makes no sense." "Don't be casual about the word dying, honey. Some people really are dying right now, and terrible deaths, too. They'd be glad to be in your shoes. Getting rejected by a fiancé would be like a big mosquito bite to them." "Look, your father's home," Anita said. "That's sweet, coming home in the middle of a work day to make sure you're okay." "To make sure you're okay," Julie said, adding, "and it's not accurate to say he rejected me." Winnie took her hands out of her pockets.
"How's everyone? Everyone doing good?"
Jim Harwood was a slightly built man with a nature of relentless congeniality. He was a recovered alcoholic, going 3 times a week to AA meetings. He was not Julie's father, who had run off with another woman when Julie was a kid, but he treated her kindly, as he treated everyone. Whether or not their mother had married him while he was still a drunk, Winnie didn't know. All of Winnie's life he had worked as a janitor at the school. Maintenance supervisor, their mother had said once to Julie. And don't you ever forget it.
We're fine, Jim, said Anita now, holding the door as he brought in a bag of groceries.
Look at this, girls. Your father's done the shopping.
Julie, why don't you make pancakes?
It was a family custom to have pancakes on Sunday nights. This was Friday noontime.
I don't want to make pancakes, said Julie.
She had started to cry soundlessly and was wiping her face with her hands.
Well, I'm afraid that's too bad, said their mother. Julie, sweetheart, if you keep on with this crying, I'm going right through the roof.
Anita tossed the sponge into the sink.
Right through the roof, understand?
Mom, my God!
And stop with the swearing, sweetheart. God has his hands full without you calling upon him in vain. Routine, Julie. Routine is what makes prisons and armies work.
Winnie said, I'll make the pancakes.
She wanted her mother to stop talking about prisons and armies. Her mother had been talking about prisons and armies ever since those pictures had come out with the hooded prisoners overseas and American soldiers leading them around on leashes like dogs. We deserve everything we get, her mother had said a few months ago in the grocery store, talking loudly to Marlene Bonney. And Cliff Mott, who had a big yellow ribbon decal on his truck because of his grandson, had come around from behind the cereal aisle and said,
Be careful with your crazy talk, Anita.
All right, Winnie, said her mother. You make the pancakes.
Want some help?
Asked her father. He had taken some eggs from the grocery bag and leaned to switch on the radio.
No, Winnie said. I'll do it.
Yes, said her mother.
Jim, get the bowl out.
He got the mixing bowl from the cupboard while Frank Sinatra's voice rose, fell, then rose again. My way.
Oh, please, Julie said. Please, please, please turn that off.
Jim, Anita said, turn the radio off. Winnie was the one to lean over and turn the radio off. She wanted Julie to see that she was the one who had done it, but Julie wasn't looking.
Julie, sweetheart, said their mother, this can't go on forever. The family has the right to listen to the radio. You know, eventually.
It's been 4 days, Julie said.
She wiped her nose on the sleeve of her sweatshirt.
Come on.
6, said her mother. Today is day 6.
Mom, please, just give me a break.
Winnie thought someone should give her a tranquilizer. Uncle Kyle had brought some over, but their mother only doled them out at night now, breaking them in half. Winnie woke up sometimes and could tell Julie was awake. Last night the moon had been full and their bedroom had had white all through it.
Julie,
Winnie had whispered,
are you awake?
Julie hadn't answered. Winnie had turned over and looked through the window at the moon. It had been huge, hanging over the water like something swollen. If there'd been a curtain, Winnie would have closed it, but they didn't have curtains in their house. They lived on the end of a long dirt road, and their mother had said there was no need for curtains, although a year ago she had hung fishnet up around the edges of the windows in the living room for decoration. She'd sent Winnie and Julie down to the shore to get starfish, all different sizes, so she could dry them out and stick them on the fishnet curtains. Julie and Winnie had walked over the seaweed, flipping back rocks, stacking up a pile of bumpy-skinned starfish.
This has to do with her father.
And mine, Julie had said.
Julie was the only person who told Winnie stuff like that.
She misses both of them. Her father used to bring her starfish at the end of the day when she was a kid. And then she wanted Ted to do that, too, and he did for a while.
That was a long time ago,
Winnie had said, peeling a starfish off a rock, a little one, its leg ripped as she pulled. She put the starfish back onto the rock. They grew new legs if they lost them.
Doesn't matter, Julie had said. Missing someone doesn't stop.
Their grandfather had been a fisherman whose boat had gotten stuck on a ledge out at sea. The newspaper clipping was in the same scrapbook showing the picture of Anita as Miss Potato Queen. "People used to call her Tater Tits," Julie told Winnie. "Don't tell her I told you, she told me." Anita had married Ted, a carpenter, because she was pregnant with Julie, but Ted had never wanted to stay with anyone for long. Julie said he had made that clear from the beginning. So she lost both of them in just a couple of years. Julie peered into the pail of starfish. "We have enough. Let's go." Walking back over the rocks, Julie added, "Bruce told me most fishermen can't swim. It's funny I didn't know that." Winnie was surprised Bruce knew that. He wasn't from around here. He'd come up from Boston and rented a cottage for a month with his brothers, and Winnie didn't know how he would know if fishermen could swim. "Bruce told me most fishermen can't swim. It's funny I didn't know that." Winnie was surprised Bruce knew that. He wasn't from around here. He'd come up from Boston and rented a cottage for a month with his brothers, and Winnie didn't know how he would know if fishermen could swim.
"Could he swim?"
Winnie asked Julie. She meant their grandfather, but she didn't have a name to call him since he was never mentioned.
"Nope. He had to just sit on that boat with the other guy, watching the tide come in. He'd have known he was going to drown. That's the part that makes Mom nuts, I think."
After their mother put the starfish in the fishnet curtains, they began to smell because they hadn't been dried out enough first, and Anita threw them out. Winnie watched while her mother stood on the porch, leaning over the rail, throwing the starfish back into the ocean one by one. She wore a pale green dress that the wind moved so it showed her figure, her breasts, her tiny waist, her long bare legs. Her feet arched as she lifted up onto her toes to throw the starfish out. Winnie heard a sound like a little scream come from her mother as she threw the last one.
"Honey," Anita said to Julie now, "take a shower. You'll feel a whole lot better." "I don't want to take a shower," said Julie, still leaning in the doorway, wiping her sleeve across her mouth.
"Now why not?" asked her mother. "What's the difference between crying in the kitchen and crying in the shower?" She put a hand on her hip, and Winnie saw the pink fingernail polish, perfectly done, on her mother's fingertips.
"Because I don't want to take my clothes off. I don't want to see my body."
Anita's jaw got hard, and she nodded her head in tiny nods.
"Winifred, watch your sleeve near that flame. Another catastrophe right now, and I'm liable to kill someone."
Their house didn't have a shower and a bathroom the way most houses did. There was a shower stall off the hallway, and across from that was a closet with a chemical toilet, a barrel-shaped plastic thing that made a whirring sound when you pushed a button to flush it. There wasn't any door for this closet, just a curtain to pull. Sometimes if Anita walked by, she'd say, "Whew, who just had a movement?" If you wanted to take a shower, you told people to stay out of the hallway. Otherwise, you had to get undressed inside the metal shower stall and toss your clothes out into the hall, then wait for the water to warm up as you pressed against the stall's metal side. Julie left the kitchen, and soon there was the sound of the shower spraying.
"I'm taking a shower," Julie called loudly, "so please stay out."
"No intention of bothering you," Anita called back. Winnie set the table and poured some juice. When the shower turned off, they could all hear the sound of Julie's crying.
"I don't know if I can stand this another minute," said Anita, drumming her nails against the counter.
"Give it time," said Jim.
He poured pancake batter into the frying pan.
"Time," said Anita, pointing toward the hall. "Jimmy, I have given that girl half my life."
"Well," said Jim, winking at Winnie.
"Well? Well, hell! I'm really, really getting tired of this."
"Your hair looks good, Mom," Winnie said.
"It should," said Anita. It cost 2 months of groceries.
Julie came back into the kitchen, her wet hair stuck to her head, the ends dripping onto her red sweatshirt, making it dark on the shoulders. Winnie saw her father flip a pancake made in the wobbly shape of a J.
A J for my jewel,
he said to Julie, and that made Winnie wonder what had happened to the wedding rings. The limousine had caused some tension. At first, the driver refused to come to the house. He said they should have mentioned the dirt road, that the branches would scratch the paint.
Julie's not walking down a dirt road in her damn wedding dress, Anita said to her husband. You make that driver drive the foolish car up here.
The limousine had been Anita's idea. Jim, looking all scrubbed and pink in his rented tuxedo, stepped outside and talked to the driver. In a few minutes, he went into the cellar and came back up with some hedge clippers. Then he and the driver disappeared down the driveway, and a few minutes later the limousine drove up, Jim waving from the front seat. Bruce arrived at the house looking sick.
You can't see the bride before the wedding, Anita called through the window. Bruce, dear God!
She started to run to the door, but Bruce had already stepped inside, and when Anita saw his face, she stopped what she was saying. Julie, coming right up behind her, didn't say anything either. Julie and Bruce went out onto the back lawn, which wasn't so much a lawn as a kind of clearing of roots and pine needles. Winnie watched through the window with her mother. Jim got out of the limousine and came inside and watched with them. Julie looked like an ad from a magazine, standing there next to a bayberry bush in her gown, the white train folded on itself but still flowing behind her, 6 feet long.
Jimmy, Anita said, people are at the church.
But he didn't answer. The three of them kept standing there, watching through the window. Julie and Bruce hardly moved. They didn't touch each other or even move their arms. And then Bruce stepped through the bayberry bushes and headed to the road. Julie came back to the house like a walking Barbie doll, and the three of them were at the screen door when she came in.
Mommy,
said Julie quietly. Her eyes weren't quite right.
This isn't happening, is it?
Uncle Kyle showed up with pills. Jim spoke to the limousine driver and then went off to the church. The limousine drove away, catching the leaves of a poplar tree in its back fender above the tire, and Winnie sat on the steps in her bridesmaid dress. After a while, her father came back.
Guess you can take that off, Winnie Doodle,
he said, but Winnie just kept sitting there. Her father went inside, and when he came back out, he said,
Julie's resting on our bed along with your mother.
Winnie figured that meant Uncle Kyle had drugged them both. She sat on the steps until she had to go to the bathroom. She didn't like going to the bathroom in the house anymore, behind the curtain like that, when everyone was home. But no one was around when she went inside. She could hear her father downstairs in the cellar, and her parents' bedroom door was closed. In a few minutes, though, the door opened and her mother walked out. She had on her old blue skirt with a pink sweater, and she didn't look the least bit drugged. Jim Harwood had been building a boat for years. It was going to be a big boat. The frame took up a lot of the cellar. For almost a year, he hadn't done anything more than spread the blueprints out onto the living room floor and look at them each night. But finally, he went into the cellar and set up 2 sawhorses. Every night, the family could hear the electric saw buzzing, and sometimes the sound of hammering, and very slowly the curved-out skeleton of a boat began to appear. The boat stayed in its skeleton shape for a long time. Jim kept going down there night after night to work on it.
It's at the slow point now, Winnie Doodle, he said.
He had to press pieces of wood in clamps to get them to arch the right way, and then he'd varnish the wood carefully and put over each nail gummy cement that took 4 days to dry.
How are you going to get it out of here when it's done?
Winnie asked him one night as she sat watching on the cellar stairs.
Good question, isn't it? He said.
He explained how he'd figured it out beforehand, mathematically,
measuring the cellar door and the circumference of the hull, and that theoretically, if he turned it at a certain angle, it should be able to get through the door when the time came.
"But I'm beginning to wonder," he said.
Winnie wondered, too. The boat was looking awfully big.
"Well, then, it will be like a ship in a bottle," she said, "like the ones at Moody's store."
"That's right," said her father. "It'll be kind of like that, I guess."
When Winnie was smaller, she used to play in the cellar with Julie. Sometimes Julie would play store with her, with the canned food their mother bought, pushing it across a table, pretending to ring it up. Now the cellar was pretty much taken over by the boat and her father's tools. He had built shelves along the wall. Up on top was an old rifle that had been around for years, and on the shelves below were wooden boxes filled with cords and nails and bolts, separated according to size. Sun streamed through the window over the kitchen sink. Winnie could see dust particles floating through the air.
"Now," said her mother, putting down her coffee cup, "let's get the day figured out. Daddy's going back to the school for a bit. I'm going to feed my roses. And what are you girls up to?"
She raised her eyebrows and tapped her painted fingernails on the table. Julie and Winnie didn't say anything. Winnie put her finger on the top of the syrup and then into her mouth.
"Winnie, please, don't be a pig," her mother said, standing up, putting her coffee cup into the sink. "Julie, you'll be a lot better off when you figure out what to do."
One thing Anita had found to do the day there wasn't a wedding was write Bruce a letter. She told him she would shoot him if she ever saw him again, if he ever came close to her daughter.
"That's a federal crime, I think," Jim had told her quietly, "putting a threat in the mail."
"Federal crime be damned," Anita said. "He's the one who did a federal crime."
Winnie remembered Cliff Mott telling her mother in the grocery store to stop her crazy talk. It was a strange feeling to go from being proud of your pretty mother to wondering what people said about her, if maybe she was nuts. And Winnie suddenly thought how her mother didn't have close friends the way other mothers did. She didn't talk on the phone or go shopping with anyone. Now Winnie sat with Julie at the kitchen table and saw through the window her mother walking around to the rose bushes, a trowel in her hand.
"You know what this is all about, don't you?" Julie said quietly. "Sex."
Winnie nodded, but she didn't know exactly. The sun, bright in the kitchen, was giving her a headache.
"She can't stand that I had sex with him."
Winnie got up and dried a plate and put it away. Julie was staring straight in front of her, blankly, like she wasn't really looking at anything. Winnie had seen her mother looking that way sometimes.
"Winnie," Julie said, still staring, "always lie to Mom. Remember I said that to you? Just lie. Lie your head off."
Winnie dried another plate. The gist of it was that Bruce had gotten scared. He didn't want to break up with Julie. He just didn't want to marry her. He wanted to live with her instead. Anita had told Julie that if she wanted to live like a common slut with a man who had left her so publicly at the altar, she could expect to never come home again.
"She doesn't mean it," Winnie had said to Julie. "People live with each other all over the place."
"You want to bet?
You want to bet she doesn't mean it?"
Julie had said, and Winnie had felt something almost like car sickness. She guessed she didn't want to bet on anything where their mother was concerned.
"Paint a picture, read a book, hook a rug."
Anita's hand slapped the table with each suggestion. Julie wasn't answering. She sat nibbling a cracker while Anita and Winnie had soup. They had made it through another day. It was Saturday lunch.
"Clean the windows," Anita said. "Winnie, don't drink from the bowl like a pig."
Anita wiped her mouth with a paper towel, which is what they used for napkins.
"What you should do is call Beth Marden and see about having your job back at the nursery school this fall."
Anita stood and put her bowl into the sink.
"No," said Julie.
Say, I know. Her mother was pleased about this one. Winnie could tell. When her mother's eyes got shiny like that, it made Winnie want to hug her, the way you'd want to hug some child who'd gotten confused about something.
Oatmeal cookie dough, Anita said.
She nodded at Julie, then at Winnie.
We'll make a batch, and we won't bake any. We'll just eat it all as dough.
Julie didn't say anything. She started picking at her nail.
So what do you say?
Anita asked.
I don't think so, Julie said, glancing up at her. I mean, thank you, though. It was a nice idea.
Anita's face got blank, like she couldn't find the expression to put on it.
Julie, Winnie said, come on. It'll be fun.
She got up and brought out a bowl and a spoon and the measuring cups. Anita walked out of the kitchen, and they heard the front door open and close. Anita was supposed to be working today at her job as a cashier at the hospital's coffee shop. She had called in sick. Through the window, Winnie saw their mother move past the bayberry bushes and head down the road to where her goldfish pool was. The first year Anita made the goldfish pool, she let the fish freeze in the ice for the winter. She said she'd heard you could do that, that they'd thaw out in the spring. Winnie used to scrape the snow off sometimes to look at the blurry orange spots in the ice.
I guess I blew that, huh?
Julie said. She sat with her chin in her hands. Winnie didn't know if she should start the cookie dough or not. She took some butter out of the refrigerator, and the telephone began to ring.
Get that, Julie said, sitting up straight. Quick!
She was in the chair by the corner, and she started pushing at the other chairs that were in her way. The phone rang another ring.
Are you home?
Winnie asked.
You know, if it's Bruce or something. Winnie, just get it, Julie said. Before Mom hears it, hurry. Yes, of course I'm home.
Hello, Winnie said.
Who?
Julie mouthed. Who?
Hello,
said Jim.
How's everything?
Hi, Daddy,
Winnie said. Julie turned and left the kitchen.
I'm just checking in,
said Jim.
Checking in.
When Winnie hung up, the phone started to ring again.
Hello,
she said. No one said anything.
Hello,
she said again. Through the phone, she heard the sound of a tiny bell.
Winnie,
said Bruce.
I want to talk to Julie, without your mother around.
Here I am, said Anita, coming through the back door. What's the story with the cookie dough? You kids decide to make it or not.
I don't know, Winnie said, still holding the phone.
Who's that?
Her mother asked.
Okay, goodbye,
Winnie said into the phone and hung up.
Who was that?
Her mother said.
Was that Bruce? Winifred, tell me, was that Bruce?
Winnie turned around.
It was Daddy,
she said, not looking at her mother.
He'll be home pretty soon.
Oh, said her mother.
Well.
Winnie put a stick of butter in the bowl and tried to smush it with a spoon. Moody's store, she thought. The bell she'd heard when Bruce called was the little bell on the screen door at Moody's. Anita said,
one of the fish has that fungus again.
Julie was down on the shore, sitting on a rock not much bigger than her bottom, staring out at the water. She turned her head slightly when Winnie's feet made a sound on the seaweed. Then she looked back at the water. Winnie turned over rocks, looking for white periwinkles. She used to collect them when she was little, watching the way their muscly foot would cling to the rock and then close up tight when she touched it with her hand. But today, Winnie left them alone. The desire to collect them was gone. It was only habit that made her look. A lobster boat passed by, and Winnie waved. It was good manners to wave to someone in a boat.
Bruce called,
she said. Julie turned her head.
And it wasn't from Boston either, I think. I think he was up at Moody's.
A loud bang sounded from up by the road.
He called?
Julie said. There was another bang.
What is that?
Winnie said.
Fireworks? Oh, Jesus,
Julie said, scrambling up over the rocks.
Winnie, that was a gun!
Anita was in the driveway holding the rifle with both her hands, but carefully, sort of, not aiming it at anything. "Hi there," she said. Her eyes were shiny, and there were drops of sweat in the pale pockets of skin right below them.
"What are you doing?"
Julie said. Anita looked back at the rifle in her hands, looking down at the end of it.
"Mom?"
Julie said.
"He's all right," said Anita. She kept looking at the gun, peering at the trigger. "He drove up and drove away, that's all."
Her finger was on the trigger. "This hasn't been used in years," she said. "I think it got jammed. Don't these things sometimes get jammed?"
"Mom,"
said Winnie, and there was this sharp, short crack of a sound, and the gravel in the driveway sprayed out. Julie screamed, and Anita screamed, only hers was a surprised shout, really, but Julie's scream kept on going. Anita held the gun away from herself. "Goodness," she said. Julie ran to the house, yelling. Anita was rubbing her arm.
"Mommy?" Winnie said. "Are you all right?"
"Oh, sweetie," she answered, brushing a hand across her forehead. "It's kind of hard to say."
This time Anita did take a pill. Winnie saw her take it, obediently at the kitchen sink when Uncle Kyle asked her to, and then she went to bed. Uncle Kyle asked Julie if Bruce was the type to press charges, and Julie and Jim both said no. And then Julie asked Jim if she could call Bruce on his cell phone later, just to make sure, and Jim said yes, she could do that, that Anita would probably sleep right through until morning. Winnie went out the back door and around to the side of the house where there were ferns and lily leaves pressed against the foundation, and she looked into her mother's bedroom window. Anita lay on her side with her hands tucked under her cheeks, her eyes closed, her mouth partly open. She seemed bigger than usual. The tops of her arms and her bare ankles were pale and fleshier than Winnie had noticed before. There was something deeply uncomfortable about the sight, as though Winnie had come across her mother naked. She went down to the shore and gathered up some starfish and laid them out on a big rock above the tide line to dry. The sun was setting over the water. Winnie watched it through the bedroom window. It looked like the postcards they sold at Moody's. On her bed, Julie sat painting her fingernails. She had spoken to Bruce, who was on his way back to Boston, and no, he wouldn't press charges. But he had said he thought Anita, and Julie whispered this, leaning forward, was a fucking nut.
"That's not nice," Winnie said.
She felt herself blush.
"Oh, baby girl,"
Julie sat back.
"When you get out of here," she said, "if you ever do get out of here, you'll find out not everyone lives like this."
"Like what?"
Winnie said, sitting down on the foot of her bed.
"Lives like what?"
Julie smiled at her.
"Let's start with the toilets," she said.
She held up a pink fingernail and blew on it gently.
"People have toilets, you know, Winnie, flush toilets. Let's move on to shooting people. Most mothers don't shoot their daughters' boyfriends in the driveway."
"I know that," Winnie said. "I don't have to go away to know that. We'd have a flush toilet, too, except Daddy says a septic tank."
"I know what Daddy says," Julie told her, twisting the cap to the nail polish carefully, her fingers splayed out.
"But it's Mom. She wants to stay in this house because her poor, now lost and legendary father bought it when she got pregnant with me, and Ted didn't have a nickel to spare. Daddy'd move out of here tomorrow. He'd move into town."
"There's nothing wrong with living here," Winnie said.
Julie smiled calmly.
"Mommy's little girl."
"I am not."
"Oh, Winnie," Julie said, but she was squinting at her baby finger, and then she unscrewed the nail polish again.
"You know what Mrs. Kittredge said in class one day?" Julie asked.
Winnie waited.
"I always remember she said one day, 'Don't be scared of your hunger. If you're scared of your hunger, you'll just be one more ninny like everyone else.'"
Winnie waited, watching Julie do her baby fingernail once more with the perfect pink polish.
"Nobody knew what she meant," Julie said, holding her nail up, looking at it. What did she mean?
Winnie asked.
Well, that's just it. At first, I think most of us thought she was talking about food. I mean, we were just seventh graders. Sorry, Doodle. But as time went by, I think I understand it more.
She teaches math,
Winnie said.
I know that, Dopey. But she'd say these weird things very powerfully. That's partly why kids were scared of her.
You don't have to be scared of her if she's still teaching next year.
I am, though. Scared of her.
Julie looked at her sideways.
Lots scarier stuff right here in this house.
Winnie frowned, pushed her hand into the pillow near her on her bed.
Oh, Winnie, Julie said. Come here.
She held out her arms. Winnie stayed where she was.
Oh, poor Winnie Doodle,
Julie said, and she moved down the bed to where Winnie was, put her arms around her awkwardly, holding her hands out to keep the nail polish from smudging. Julie kissed the side of Winnie's head, and then she let her go. In the morning, Anita's eyes were puffy, as though all that sleep had exhausted her, but she sipped her coffee and said brightly,
"Whew, that was some sleep I had."
"I don't want to go to church this morning,"
Julie said.
"I'm not ready to have everyone look at me yet."
Winnie thought there might be a fight about that, but there wasn't.
"Okay,"
said Anita, after she had considered for a minute.
"All right, honey. Just don't sit around and mope while we're gone."
Julie piled the breakfast dishes into the sink, her pink nails shining.
"I won't,"
she said. In the hallway, Jim said to Winnie,
"Doodlebug, give your old father a hug."
But Winnie brushed past him, patting his arm that he held out before going to put on her church clothes. In church, she sat with her dress sticking to the pew. It was a hot summer day. The church windows were open, but there wasn't any breeze. Through the window, Winnie saw in the distance a few dark clouds. Next to her, she heard her father's stomach growl. He looked at her and winked. But Winnie looked out the window again. She thought how she had passed by him when he'd asked for a hug, how she had seen her mother do that to him, too. Only sometimes Anita would touch his shoulders and kiss the air beside his cheek.
Maybe Julie was right. She was Mommy's girl, and maybe Winnie was going to turn out to be like her, someone who brushed past people even when she was smiling. Maybe she'd grow up and shoot people in the driveway with a rifle.
Tiredly, she stood up for the hymn. Her mother reached to straighten a wrinkle in the back of Winnie's dress. On Winnie's pillow was a folded note.
"Please make them think I'm out taking a walk. I've gone to Moody's to catch the bus. My life depends on this. I love you, Doodle, I do."
Hot tingles shot through Winnie's arms and fingers. Even her nose and chin tingled.
"Winifred," her mother called, "come peel some potatoes, please."
The bus to Boston stopped at Moody's at 11:30. Julie would still be there, probably trying to stay out of sight, maybe sitting in the grass behind the store.
They could go get her in the car. She'd cry, and there'd be a big fight, and someone might have to give her a pill, but they could still do it. She was still there.
"Winifred?"
Anita called again. Winnie took her church clothes off, took her hair out of its ponytail so the hair would fall in front of her face.
"You all right?"
Anita asked.
"I have a headache."
Winnie scooched down and took some potatoes from the bin in the bottom cupboard.
"You need some food in your stomach," her mother said. "Where's your sister? You'd think she could have started the potatoes."
Anita put the Sunday steak into the broiling pan. Winnie washed the potatoes and started to peel them. She filled a pot with water and cut the potatoes. They plopped into the water. She looked at the clock above the stove.
"Where is she?"
Anita asked again.
"Gone for a walk, I think,"
Winnie said.
"Well, we're about to eat,"
her mother said, and then Winnie almost cried. Uncle Kyle had told a story once about being on a train that hit and killed a teenage girl. He said he would never forget how he sat there, looking out the window of the train as they waited for the police, thinking about the girl's parents, how they would still be in their house watching TV or doing the dishes, not even knowing that their daughter was dead, while he sat on the train and knew.
"I'll go look for her," Winnie said.
She rinsed her hands and dried them. Anita glanced at the clock and turned over the steak.
"Just give a holler," she said, "out by the back woods."
Winnie opened the back door and stepped outside. The clouds were moving in. The air had gotten chilly and smelled like the ocean. Her father stepped out onto the back porch.
"About to eat, Winnie."
Winnie pulled at the leaves of a bayberry bush.
"Look kind of lonesome out there," he said.
The phone rang in the kitchen. Her father went back inside, and Winnie followed, watching from the hall.
"Yes. Hello, Kyle," her mother said.
In the afternoon, it started to rain. The house got dark, and the rain beat down on the roof and against the big window pane in the living room. Winnie sat in a chair and watched the ocean, choppy and gray. Uncle Kyle had gone to Moody's for a paper, and he had seen Julie up near the back of the bus as it pulled away. Anita had rushed into the girl's bedroom, tearing things apart. Julie's duffel bag was gone, and most of her underwear and her makeup, too. Anita found Julie's note to Winnie.
"You knew,"
she said to Winnie, and Winnie understood that something had changed for good, something more than Julie's running away. Uncle Kyle had come over, but now he was gone. Winnie sat in the living room with her father. She kept thinking of Julie on the bus, riding through the rain, staring out the window at the turnpike going by. She thought her father was probably picturing this too, maybe imagining the sound of the bus's windshield wipers going back and forth.
"What are you going to do when you finish the boat?" Winnie asked.
Her father looked surprised.
"Well," he said, "don't know. Go for a ride, I guess."
Winnie smiled to be nice because she didn't think he'd be going anywhere.
"That'll be fun," she said.
Toward evening, the rain stopped. Anita hadn't come out of her room. Winnie tried to figure out if Julie was there yet. She didn't know how long it took to get to Boston, but it took a long time.
"I wonder if she's got some money with her," her father said,
but Winnie didn't answer. She didn't know. Rain dripped from the side of the roof and off the trees. She thought of all the starfish she had laid out on the rock, all of them drenched from the rain. After a while, her father stood up and went to the window.
"Didn't plan on things working out like this," he said,
and Winnie had a sudden thought of him on his own wedding day. Unlike Anita, he had not been married before. Anita had not worn a white dress because of Julie.
"You only wear white once," Anita had said.
There were no wedding pictures, that Winnie knew of anyway, of her parents' wedding day. Her father turned around.
"Pancakes?"
he asked her. Winnie didn't want pancakes.
"Sure," she said.
Security. It was May, and Olive Kittredge was going to New York. She had never in her 72 years set foot in the city, although she had on two occasions many years ago sat in a car and ridden past it, Henry at the wheel, worried about this exit and that, and seen from a distance the skyline, buildings against buildings, gray against a gray sky. Like a science fiction city it had seemed, built on a moon. It held no appeal, not then, not now, although back when those planes ripped through the towers, Olive had sat in her bedroom and wept like a baby. Not so much for this country, but for the city itself, which had seemed to her to become suddenly no longer a foreign, hardened place, but as fragile as a class of kindergarten children, brave in their terror. Jumping from the windows, it clutched her heart, and she had felt a private, sickening shame to know that two of the dark-haired hijackers, silently thrilled with their self-righteousness, had come down through Canada and walked through the airport in Portland on their way to such hellacious destruction. She might have driven right by them that morning. Who knows? Time passed, though, as it does, and the city, at least from Olive's faraway vantage, seemed eventually itself again, no place she cared to go, in spite of the fact that her only son had moved there recently, acquired a second wife and two children, not his. The new wife, Anne, if you were to believe the one photograph that took ages to download, was as tall and big as a man, pregnant now with Christopher's child, and according to a characteristically cryptic email from Chris, with no attention paid to punctuation or any use of capital letters, Anne was tired and had pukes. In addition, it seemed Theodore turned into a hellion each morning before going off to preschool. Olive had been summoned to help. The request had not been put this way. After sending the note, Christopher had called from his office and said,
"Anne and I've been hoping you'll come visit for a couple of weeks."
To Olive, this meant they needed help. It had been years since she'd been in the company of her son for a couple of weeks. 3 days, she said. After that, I stink like fish.
A week, then,
Chris had countered, adding,
you could walk Theodore to school. It's around the corner, one block.
Like hell, she thought. Her tulips, seen right there through her dining room window, jubilant cups of yellow and red, would be dead by the time she got back. Give me a few days to make the arrangements, she said. The arrangements took 20 minutes. She called Emily Buck at the post office and told her to hold her mail.
Oh, this'll be good for you, Olive,
said Emily. Yep, said Olive. I'm sure. Then she called Daisy up the road and asked her to water the garden. Daisy, who'd had fantasies, Olive was certain of this, of living out her widowhood with Henry Kittredge if only Olive could have died early on, said she would be glad to water the garden.
Henry was always so good about watering mine when I went to see Mother,
Daisy said. Daisy added,
this will be good for you, Olive. You'll have a good time.
A good time was not something Olive expected to have again. That afternoon, she drove to the nursing home and explained to Henry what she was up to, while he sat motionless in his wheelchair, the expression on his face one he frequently wore, that of confused politeness, as though something had been placed on his lap that he could not comprehend, but which he felt required a polite expression of thanks. Whether or not he was deaf, there was still some question. Olive did not believe he was, nor did Cindy, the one nice nurse. Olive gave Cindy the number in New York.
She a good person, this new one?
Cindy counted pills into Dixie cups.
Haven't a clue, Olive said.
Fertile, though, I guess, Cindy said, picking up the tray of meds.
Olive had never been in a plane by herself. Not that she was by herself now, of course. There were 4 other passengers with her in this plane, which was half the size of a Greyhound bus. All of them had gone through security with the complacency of cows, Olive seeming the only one with trepidation. She'd had to remove her suede sandals and the big Timex watch of Henry's that she wore on her large wrist. Perhaps it was the queer intimacy of standing there in her pantyhosed feet, worried that the watch might not work after it went through the machine, that made her, for 1/2 a second, fall in love with the big security fellow, who said kindly,
"There you go, ma'am,"
handing her the plastic bowl that had rolled toward her with the watch in it. The pilots as well, both looking 12 years old with their unworried brows, had been kind. In the easy way they'd asked Olive if she'd mind sitting toward the back for weight distribution before they climbed into the cockpit, closing the steel door. A thought unfolded before her. Their mothers should be proud. And then, as the little plane climbed higher and Olive saw spread out below them fields of bright and tender green in this morning sun, farther out the coastline, the ocean shiny and almost flat, tiny white wakes behind a few lobster boats. Then Olive felt something she had not expected to feel again, a sudden surging greediness for life. She leaned forward, peering out the window. Sweet, pale clouds, the sky as blue as your hat, the new green of the fields, the broad expanse of water. Seen from up here, it all appeared wondrous, amazing. She remembered what hope was, and this was it. That inner churning that moves you forward, plows you through life the way the boats below plowed the shiny water, the way the plane was plowing forward to a place new and where she was needed. She had been asked to be part of her son's life. But at the airport, Christopher seemed furious. She had forgotten that, because of security, he would not be able to meet her at the gate, and apparently it hadn't occurred to him to remind her. Why this should make him so angry, Olive couldn't figure out. She was the one who had wandered around the luggage area with panic bubbling through her, her face hot as fire by the time Christopher found her lumbering back up the stairs.
"Godfrey,"
he said, not even reaching to take her bag.
"Why can't you just get a cell phone like everyone else?"
It was not until later, hurtling down an expressway with four lanes and more cars than Olive had ever seen moving together, that Christopher said,
"So, how is he?"
"The same," she answered, and said nothing more until they had taken an exit and were moving through streets lined with uneven buildings, Christopher lurching the car around double-parked trucks.
"How's Anne?"
Olive asked then, shifting her feet for the first time since she'd gotten into the car, and Christopher said,
"Uncomfortable,"
adding in a didactic, doctorish tone,
"It gets very uncomfortable."
As though entirely ignorant of the fact that Olive herself had once been pregnant. Uncomfortable.
"And Annabelle's waking up in the night again."
"Ducky," said Olive.
"Duck soup."
The buildings were lower now, all with steep stoops in the front. She said,
"You indicated little Teddy's become quite a handful."
"Theodore," said Christopher.
"God, whatever you do, don't call him Teddy."
He pulled the car up sharply and backed into a space near the sidewalk.
"Honestly, Mom,"
Christopher ducked his head, his blue eyes looking straight into hers the way he would do years ago. He said softly,
"Theodore has always been a little piece of crap."
Confusion, which had started the moment she had stepped off the plane and not found anyone waiting for her, and which had then grown into an active panic on the airport's escalator, changing into a stunned block of perfect oddness the whole drive in, now, as Olive stepped from the car onto the sidewalk, seemed to cause everything to sway around her, so that reaching to get her bag from the back seat, she actually stumbled and fell against the car.
"Easy, Mom," said Christopher. "I'll get the bag. Just watch where you step."
"Oh, goodness," she said, for already her foot had landed on a crusty roll of dog mess there on the sidewalk.
"Oh, hell." "I hate that,"
Christopher said. He took her arm.
"It's the guy who works on the subway and comes home early in the mornings. I've seen him out here while his dog takes a shit, looking around to see no one'll catch him, just leaving it there."
"My goodness," said Olive, because adding to her confusion was the additional factor of her son's loquaciousness. She had seldom heard him speak so passionately or for so long, and she was quite certain she had never heard him use the word shit. She laughed, a false, hard sound. The earlier clarity of the young pilot's faces came to her as something she had dreamed. Christopher unlocked a grated gate beneath a large brown stoop of stairs and stepped back to let her enter.
"So this is your house," she said, and gave that laugh again, because she could have wept at the darkness, the smell of old dog hair and soiled laundry, the sourness that seemed to come from the walls.
The house she and Henry had built for Chris back home in Maine had been beautiful, filled with light, the windows large to show the lawns and lilies and fir trees. She stepped on a plastic toy and almost broke her neck.
"Where is everyone?" she asked. "Christopher, I've got to take off that shoe before I track dog mess all through the house." "Just leave it here," he said, stepping past her.
And so she slipped off the one suede sandal and walking through a dark hallway, she thought how she had forgotten to bring another pair of pantyhose.
"They're out back in the garden," said her son,
and she followed him through a capacious, dark living room into a small kitchen that was cluttered with toys, a high chair, pots spread over the counter, open boxes of cereal, and minute rice. A grimy white sock lay on the table. And suddenly it seemed to Olive that every house she had ever gone into depressed her, except for her own, and the one they had built for Christopher. It was as though she had never outgrown that feeling she must have had as a child, that hypersensitivity to the foreign smell of someone else's home, the fear that coated the unfamiliar way a bathroom door closed, the creak in a staircase worn by footsteps, not one's own. She emerged, blinking, into a small outdoor area. This could not possibly be what he meant as a garden. She stood on a square of concrete. Around her was a chicken wire fence that had been knocked into by something large enough to leave a whole section gaping and broken. A child's plastic swimming pool was before her. In it, a naked baby sat, staring at her, while a small, dark-haired boy stood nearby, his wet swim trunk sticking to his skinny thighs. He stared at her as well. Behind him, a black dog lay on an old dog bed. Not far from Olive, a wooden staircase rose, leading to a wooden deck above her head. From the shadow beneath the stairs came the word, "Olive!" A woman appeared, holding a barbecue spatula. "Gosh, there you are! What a sight for sore eyes! I am so glad to meet you, Olive!" Briefly, Olive had the image of a huge, walking girl doll. The hair was black and cut straight above the shoulders, the face as open and guileless as a simpleton's. "You must be Anne," said Olive, but the words were lost in a hug the large girl wrapped her in, the spatula falling to the ground, causing the dog to groan and stand up. Olive could see this from just a sliver of vision left to her. Taller than Olive, and with a stomach huge and hard, this Anne held her long arms around her and kissed the side of Olive's head. Olive did not kiss people, and to be held in the arms of a woman taller than she was, well, Olive was positive this had never happened before.
"Do you mind if I call you Mom?"
asked the girl, stepping back but holding Olive by her elbows.
"I'm so dying to call you Mom."
"Call me anything you want," Olive replied. "I guess I'll call you Anne."
The boy moved like a slithery animal to grab hold of his mother's ample thigh.
"You're Thaddeus, I suppose," said Olive.
The boy began to cry.
"Theodore," said Anne. "Honey, that's all right. People make mistakes. We've talked about that, right?"
A rash stood out high on Anne's cheek and ran down the side of her neck, where it disappeared under a huge black T-shirt worn over black leggings. Her feet were bare. Bits of a pink polish were on her toenails.
"Perhaps I'd better sit down," Olive said.
"Oh, absolutely," Anne said. "Honey, pull that chair over here for your mother."
In the midst of the aluminum beach chair scraping across the cement and the boy crying and Anne saying,
"God, Theodore, what is it?"
In the midst of all this, one shoe off and one shoe on, sinking back into the beach chair, Olive distinctly heard the words,
"Praise Jesus!" "Theodore, honey, please, please, please stop crying."
In the plastic pool, the baby slapped the water and shrieked.
"Jesus, Annabelle," said Christopher. "Keep it down."
"Praise the Lord,"
came distinctly from somewhere above.
"What in God's name?"
said Olive, putting her head back, squinting upward.
"We rent the top floor to a Christian,"
Anne said in a whisper, rolling her eyes.
"I mean, who would think here in this neighborhood we'd get stuck with a tenant who's a Christian?"
"Christian?"
said Olive, looking back at her daughter-in-law, thoroughly confused.
Are you a Muslim, Anne? Is there a problem?"
"Muslim?"
The girl's plain big face looked pleasantly at Olive while she bent to pick up the baby from the pool.
"I'm not a Muslim," quizzically.
Wait, you're not a Muslim, are you? Christopher never...
Oh, Godfrey, said Olive.
What she means, Christopher explained to his mother, fiddling with a large barbecue grill near the staircase, is that most people in this neighborhood don't go to church. We live in the cool part of Brooklyn, hippity-hop as hell, mother dear, where people are either too artsy-fartsy to believe in God or too busy making money. So it's somewhat unusual to have a tenant who's a real so-called Christian.
You mean like a fundamentalist? Said Olive, amazed once again at how talkative her son had become.
Right, said Anne. That's what he is. You know, fundamentally Christian.
The boy had stopped his crying, and still holding his mother's leg, said to Olive in a high, earnest voice,
Whenever we swear, the parrot says, Praise Jesus, sir, God is king.
And to Olive's horror and amazement, the child looked skyward and yelled,
Shit!
Honey,
said Anne and smoothed his hair.
Praise God,
came the response from above.
That's a parrot, asked Olive. Good Lord, it sounds like my Aunt Aura.
Yeah, a parrot, said Anne. Weird, huh?
You couldn't have said no pets allowed.
Oh, we'd never do that. We love pets. Dogface is part of our family.
Anne nodded in the direction of the black dog, who, having returned to his ratty bed, now had his long face resting on his paws, his eyes closed. Olive could barely eat her dinner. She had thought Christopher was going to grill hamburgers, but he had grilled tofu hot dogs, and for the grown-ups had, of all things, diced up a can of oysters and poked them into these so-called hot dogs.
Are you okay, Mom?
It was Anne who asked.
Fine, said Olive. When I travel, I sometimes find I'm not hungry. I think I'll just eat this hot dog roll.
Sure, help yourself. Theodore, isn't it nice to have Grandma come and stay?
Olive put the roll back onto her plate. Not once had it occurred to her that she was Grandma to Anne's children, who had been, she only recently discovered, as the hot dogs had been set before her, fathered by two different men. Theodore did not respond to his mother's question, but gazed at Olive while he ate with his mouth open, making appalling chewing sounds. Less than 10 minutes, and the meal was over. Olive told Chris that she'd like to help clean up, but that she didn't know where anything went.
Nowhere, Chris said. Can't you tell? In this house, nothing goes anywhere.
Mom, you go make yourself comfortable, Anne said.
So Olive went down into the basement, where they had brought her earlier with her little suitcase, and she lay down on the double bed. The fact was, the basement was the nicest place Olive had seen in the house. It was finished and painted all white, and even had, next to the washing machine, a white telephone. She wanted to cry. She wanted to wail like a child. She sat up and dialed the phone.
Put him on, she said, and waited until she could hear only silence. Smack, Henry, she said, and she waited a while longer until she thought she heard a tiny grunt. Well, she's a big girl, said Olive, your new daughter-in-law. Graceful as a truck driver. A little dumb, I think. Something I can't put my finger on. But nice, you'd like her. You two would get along fine.
Olive looked around the basement room she was in and thought she heard Henry grunt again.
No, she's not going to hightail it up the coast any time soon. Got her hands full here. Belly full, too. They've got me down in the basement. It's kind of nice, Henry. Painted white.
She tried to think what else to say, what Henry would want to hear.
Chris seems good, she said.
She paused for a long time after that.
Talkative, she added.
Okay, Henry, she finally said, and hung up.
Back upstairs, no one was around. Thinking they must be putting the children to bed, Olive stepped through the kitchen and out onto the concrete yard, where twilight was gathering.
Caught me, said Anne,
and Olive's heart banged.
Godfrey, you caught me. I didn't see you sitting there.
Anne was holding a cigarette in one hand, balancing a beer on her high belly with the other, her legs apart as she sat on a stool by the barbecue.
Have a seat,
Anne said, gesturing toward the beach chair Olive had been sitting in earlier.
Unless it makes you crazy to see a pregnant woman drink and smoke, which I totally understand if it does, but it's just one cigarette and one beer a day. You know, when the kids finally get put down. I call it my meditation time.
I see, Olive said.
Well, meditate away. I can go back inside.
Oh, no. I'd love your company.
In the dusk, she saw the girl smile at her. Say what you might about judging a book by its cover, Olive always found faces revealing. Still, the bovine nature of this girl was baffling. Was Anne a bit stupid? Olive had taught school enough years to know that large amounts of insecurity could take the form of stupidity. She lowered herself into her chair and looked away. She didn't want to guess what